Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's always been simple and clear. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hello, Corey.
Hello to any new listeners who may have joined us from hearing us on Nevermind the Bar Charts, which is Mark Pack's podcast. And hello to you. Hello to Mark. Usually we release episodes every Sunday, but Steve and I have reconvened to record a cheeky midweek episode. We've not talked very much over the last few months about the government's handling of COVID-19 on this podcast. It's something we're not really qualified to talk about, seeing as we're not epidemiologists. But we are interested in messaging and political messaging, and we have talked a lot about the Tory party over the past 4 years on this podcast. So what we are going to talk about is the government's, to put it mildly, piss-poor, shambolic, cluster-wuller-style handling of how they've eased a lockdown over the past few days. Do you want to talk us through the timeline of incompetence and woe of the government's last week?
Sure thing. So just before the bank holiday, anonymous sources, as they often so are these days, started briefing to the press that the government was considering easing some of the lockdown restrictions. No real details were given, but this allowed the press to have a bit of a field day and start talking about how life was going to go back to normal. You know, we could start going down the pubs again. Football was going to be back on. And then on Sunday, Johnson gives an announcement to the nation, supposedly about the details of how we were going to ease lockdown. The problem was there wasn't a lot of details in it at all, primarily because from what we can see, with the power of hindsight now, a lot of the details haven't actually been worked out yet. I think as of yesterday or today, there's been like a significant like 50-page document or something like that, which has been produced with a lot of information and details. And we'll get onto that probably a little bit later. But Johnson's announcement was effectively a damp squib. People came away with more questions than answers. In fact, the only thing that really got announced was, we're changing our slogan. And we're changing the colour scheme of our graphics for the slogan. It went from the three parts, stay home, protect the NHS, save lives, to a new one, which was stay alert as the main kind of area. And that's all I can really remember about it, is the fact that it's stay alert and the fact that it's the colour scheme has changed from red and yellow to green and yellow. Kind of like with kind of going from a stop to go motif behind it.
Is it stay alert, control the virus, save lives, I think?
Something like that. But the fact that, you know, we're having to think hard about it kind of shows you how not great it probably is as a slogan to inspire people to take a certain set of actions. And that slogan and the announcements the government made has left the government in a bit of a tricky position, whereby people had become confused by the guidance and didn't know what was or wasn't allowed anymore. Again, largely due to the fact that a lot of the details hadn't been made available. You then had an awful lot of the media asking questions about what can we or can't we do. You ended up in some interesting situations where, as part of the conference, as part of the announcement, Johnson says, prepare to go back to work. So everybody assumes he said that on Sunday, therefore we need to go back on Monday. But at the same time, people haven't got childcare sorted.
And also there's public transport angle. So you've got people who are being told to go back to work, but there's no actual arrangements being made for public transport either.
Yeah, because specifically Johnson did say in the announcement that if you can go to work, you should. This gives you a kind of a breakdown of how confused the messaging is, because it basically boils down to if you can't do your work job from home, you should go to work, but you can't use public transport to get to work. But then there's no indication about what you should do to get to work if you've only got access to public transport, which means people are just kind of going, well, I've got to get on public transport, which means you see images, like I think literally on Monday, of crowded tube trains. Eventually, at some point on Monday, Dominic Raab confirms that actually it's Wednesday that people should have been prepared to go back to work from.
Yeah, this is on the Today programme, I think, the 10 past 8 slot.
Yeah. So Raab makes that statement, and immediately everyone starts going, why the hell didn't you say that then? I believe that's also when they started talking about this additional documentation, which would provide more details. But again, none of that was available at the time. So that kind of is like the first phase of their communication screw up. The second bit boils down to the actual document itself, where, you know, I'm sure actually if you think it all, if you were to follow it all through from a kind of like a logical perspective of like the advice given by Sage and the experts, you can probably make a case for most of the things in there. But you end up with being told, we end up being told as part of this document that we can go outside as much as we like, we can sit on the grass and, you know, sunbathe in the park, all of those sorts of things, and we can meet a parent, as an example. Okay, so I can go see my mom, but I can't go see my stepdad. But you can, however, I could go see my mom, and then she could wander away, and then I could go straight away to see my stepdad, you know, 10 minutes later. Which is something which has been flagged specifically with Matt Hancock, the health secretary, on This Morning by Philip Schofield, of all people. So the fact that you've got Philip Schofield kind of like highlighting problematic areas of the government's approach gives you a kind of an indication about how badly things have gone. Because, you know, if you're on This Morning, this is about as fluffy and as nice a journalistic thing you're ever going to get. And they're now laying into the government and basically calling what we're calling the advice inane. You've also got the likes of Piers Morgan, who, God damn it, I've ended up agreeing with him so much over the past few weeks, which is not something that seems to happen very often. But he's been rightfully calling out the government for their failures. So there was a rather, from the Conservatives' perspective, excruciating interview with Andrew Bridgen MP, where Bridgen gives advice on like what people can and can't do that goes completely against what the government was actually saying. Morgan basically turns around and says, if you don't know, how the hell are the British people meant to know? And so you just have an absolute media catastrophe for the Conservative Party over the past week or so, where everything they kind of could have screwed up, I think they have.
Yeah, I mean, right, let's go back to, in many ways, what I think the original sin is, and then we can kind of work forwards from there. Well, it's not a very effective cabinet. No. This is a cabinet which was chosen by Boris Johnson after he was elected prime minister by how many Tory members was it? About 120,000 or something. And those cabinet members are there because they were willing to sign up to a no-deal Brexit in principle. It's a cabinet that is essentially beholden to Boris Johnson. He was the dominant figure in it. It's interesting, actually, because I think it's one of those cases where the Johnson administration, to a lot of people, feels quite new. A lot of voters have said there's this kind of new government feel, even though the Tories have been in office for 10 years. But in terms of ministerial calibre and ministerial quality, you've got actually what the thick of it, I think Malcolm Tucker refers to, like season 10 of The Big Breakfast vibes, where a lot of the more able ministers, say, have left Parliament, like George Osborne, David Gawke, Rory Stewart, latter two even have left the Tory party, I believe. A few of the other more able ministers, people like Jeremy Hunt, I'm speaking relatively able here, they are on the back benches. They are not part of the Johnsonian regime. And therefore, you end up in the ridiculous situation with Gavin Williamson, the assassin-faced baby, as education secretary. You have Priti Patel as Home Secretary, and you have Jacob Rees-Mogg as Leader of the House, none of whom are eminently qualified for their position at all.
Yep, pretty much.
So there's that element of it. I think you've also got the element of actually there's been some genuine disagreement in the Tory party and in the cabinet about how to end the lockdown and the trade-off between ending the lockdown and protecting the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a bit of a kind of like an ideological schism to a degree, actually, within the Conservatives on this. You've very much got your you're very buccaneering, kind of like right wingers, which, you know, probably loosely can are affiliated in some way, or at least there's a definite overlap with the ERG, who are very much agitating for an ease on the lockdown. Well, then you've got everyone else who's much more kind of probably less concerned about the economic damage and more concerned probably actually about the fact that this is going to impact people's lives much, much more strongly. At the moment, the government's trying to walk a tightrope where then trying to do what they can to not just give in to the ERG and its equivalents on this. But at the same time, they know that they need to actually kind of throw them a bone in some description. One might say throw them a Peter bone.
No one should ever say that.
There is genuinely a bit of a balancing act to be had in terms of lockdown and like and its effect on the economy. At the end of the day, if you do get that wrong, then actually you do end up hurting the economy, which in turn costs people their jobs, which costs people their livelihoods, which has a negative impact on people as well. If the government gets it wrong in either direction, people's lives are ruined or people will end up dead. There's not an easy answer to this. It's a very kind of like thin, narrow path they need to walk.
Well, before we start, I mean, again, I think that's a little bit kind on the government, to be honest, in terms of the line they had to walk in terms of, you know, protecting the economy, protecting lives. I mean, the head of the like Keir Starmer, I'm not going to give my own view. I'm just going to quote the experts. You know, the head of the WHO was saying from February that trace track systems were the way to go from February. And the government chose not to do that, chose to make a different approach.
Absolutely.
But those places who've done that are able to come out of a lockdown and come out. And so say like places like Italy, a much stricter lockdown, and France as well, under a much stricter lockdown than we were, yeah, have started to edge out of it. And I think that's the problem with the comparisons so far, I think. And in terms of, you know, the economy, like this is something that all European countries are going through. It's just that France and Italy are beginning to ease lockdown, having gone past the peak. Well, I mean, looking at the infection curve in Britain, it's not entirely clear if that peak's happened yet. And if you're going to shove loads of people onto crowded buses,
yeah, no, absolutely,
not great.
Absolutely, and I don't disagree with that. I mean, it is quite clear that the core strategic failure that the government did was not kind of going down the test and trace approach that was recommended. But what that effectively has done is just created an even narrower path for them, because they can't do anything other than try and get that in place, really. I mean, they don't seem to be doing a very good job of it at the moment. But at the same time, they have this external pressure from the conservative right leaning in on them to try and lift lockdown, because they're a combination of don't believe in the notion that the government or government should be limiting what people can do in terms of like telling them to stay home and things like that, or they just don't care and they're far more concerned about the state of the economy.
I think that's a very good point. I think there's a big element to this of almost, it feels like the reason why we've gone down the wrong track from the start is because there's a big element in the Tory party that doesn't believe that the state is the solution to people's problems, and doesn't believe that the government either should do big programs like the kind of test and trace and track that we've seen in South Korea, or even that they would be very good at doing so, which I think means they've kind of ended up with this herd immunity nonsense, which, again, I think it's partly that ideological thing. And I think it's also partly it's the advice that they were getting. And I mean, so Anthony Costello, who is what I think he was involved with the WHO, was saying that most people on SAGE, on the committee, are paid civil servants. So Chris Whitty is a paid civil servant. If you've got people like Dominic Cummings sitting in on SAGE, even as an observer, I imagine that might mean you don't necessarily want to be too candid. Like there's even just speaking from teaching experience, there's a difference between a lesson when you're teaching and you're not observed and a lesson when the head comes around for a learning walk. Now, a lot of the reason for that herd immunity thesis, it seems to me, just going off the record, is a lot of the government's fascination with behavioural economists and the behavioural unit kind of doing their modelling and assuming that the British public wouldn't take a long lockdown.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then the people on SAGE, you know, there's no epidemiologists, no one from nursing, there's no kind of on infectious diseases, a lack of female and BAME representation, and particularly the lack of BAME representation, given the impact that coronavirus is having on BAME communities, I think is particularly apparent. And so it's that, and we've talked about this in the previous podcast earlier in the year, Steve, is this Cummings' view of science in particular. It's like an arts graduate's view of what science seems to be. And that seems to have led the government down a particular path.
Yeah, absolutely, it does. I think you've actually kind of pinpointed one of the government's core failures in what you just said there, which is the assumption that the British public wouldn't take to an extended lockdown, and that, you know, everything we needed to do needed to be done with that in mind, that eventually we'd start getting anxious and we'd start wanting to break everything quite quickly and get back to normal as fast as we could. And the reality is that's not borne out by the evidence. So if you actually look what happened in the run-up to the government calling for lockdown, an awful lot of things had already started closing down in effect on their own. The Premier League cancelled football matches and the season on their own. You know, there were lots of things like that that happened. A lot of businesses started basically just telling people, yeah, work from home if you can, on their own. I mean, where I work, we got into a point where we weren't necessarily the fastest on the uptake on that, but we still ended up kind of moving to work from home before the government told us to. I feel like the assessment that they had of like the psychology of the British people, where we're all freedom loving individuals who are going to kind of rail against being cooped up for too long, is inaccurate. And I think that assumption is probably what's kind of spiraled into a lot of the issues they have now.
And it's interesting that in polls, actually, the British are generally the least likely to want to come out of lockdown, which is understandable when you look at the higher death rate here. That's a very good point. I think the other thing in terms of what the government did at the start is that very much an abdication of responsibility. As you say, it wasn't the government, as other countries did, like blanket shut down sports events. The Premier League had to do it themselves. I mean, there's an issue, I think, further down the line in terms of a lot of local councils get their funding from things like, say, car parking charges, other commercial ventures, office rates and stuff. So, say, Birmingham, for instance, where we are, closed its car parks. The government didn't tell them to do that. Instead, closed these things to, you know, try and discourage people from going in the centre and spreading the coronavirus. And what the government was saying at the start was, we'll cover councils for the whole cost of this. Well, now there's Robert Jenrick's making very different noises, almost, you know, well, councils voluntarily did that, and therefore we might not cover the full cost. And so I think there's a bit of a, well, don't blame us, Gov, you know, it wasn't us who did it. I can see that playing out in a lot of different areas.
One of the things that I find quite interesting is we've had a lot of, and I think we've kind of discussed this before, like war rhetoric around the around like COVID-19 and the coronavirus, and kind of trying to kind of tap into that keep calm and carry on attitude. But the interesting thing here is that an awful lot of that spirit, the spirit of the Blitz, is communitarian. It's about communities. It's about looking after each other. It's not individualistic. So the government has basically spent God knows how long basically utilizing kind of messaging and kind of like allegories, which are kind of communitarian in nature, whilst also kind of planning for a kind of like an individualistic response. And it doesn't make much sense to do that, because like it's quite clear that the British people are more than happy to kind of like, as you say, kind of lock ourselves down for whilst we feel there's a need to do so. And you can see every Thursday when people do go out on their doorstep and start banging pots and pans in support of key workers and things like that. There's a definite kind of community spirit which is there. And it's that community spirit and that kind of focus on other people and being aware of other people, which means that people are less likely to want to get out of lockdown because they're aware that they're not the only people who could be affected by this, and they're having empathy for other people who are going through these things.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you should say that. And yeah, just before going to the news cycle thing, there's a Medium post by a chap called John Alexander that's been shared quite widely. And he makes this point, actually, in relation to lockdown, is that before there was a lot of emphasis on war rhetoric, you know, it was compared to a mugger, the idea that somehow we are, essentially the government will step in and save us, and therefore they see that he what Alexander argues is that the change of the framing is very much one from the government will, you know, stay at home, NHS will sort it, the government will sort it, to stay alert. And therefore, almost the implication is if you catch the disease, it's because you weren't alert enough. And then if you somehow disagree that the, you know, you say, well, actually, this is a terrible slogan, what then the riposte is, ah, well, you don't trust the good common sense of the British people. It's an interesting article, and it argues that we need to tell a sort of a different story framed around collective effort, like you were saying. Like a more citizen story. I don't know how I... It's slightly too conspiratorial to me. Again, I think it's the symptom of the government's attitude and the Tory party's attitude, I think, to the role of the state and the role of society in a way that, like, a lot of the Labour response is about the protecting renters, not landlords, and making sure that no one's evicted from their house, not really that fussed whether landlords get their rent. And that's not a conspiracy against the landlord class. That's just a sort of extension of the ideological outlook of the Labour Party.
It's just a prioritisation based on the values and beliefs they've got. It logically makes sense. It is really interesting. And I actually do think it probably does kind of fold into moving on to like the daily news cycle stuff as well. Because it is something that the government seemingly has become focused on. And I think it's largely because it's one of the few things that's actually directly under their control at the moment. I mean, even a lot of their kind of like efforts that are directly related to, you know, dealing with the coronavirus haven't necessarily gone as strong as they would have wanted. They didn't technically make the target for getting 100,000 tests done. They did then hit it a day later, I think, which is okay. Well, fair enough.
They hit it by posting out 40,000 tests and recording them, which is the equivalent of saying you complete your essay by stating a load of blank paper to the end of your essay.
Yeah, absolutely. I was about to say, I'm not even going to get into like the veracity of that claim because there's a separate issue I do want to delve into, which is, have we hit that number again? With fiddled statistics?
I don't think so. Well, this was the Keir Starmer, and we're not going to use the adjective forensic, obviously, Steve, because we're not the cliched mainstream media. Right. But I think there was, one of his questions last week, I believe, was something along the lines of what was so special about the 30th of April that meant that we hit the 100,000 tests a day then and haven't done since.
Yeah.
Which QCs would say is a proper mic drop moment, I believe.
But again, you see that is that focus on we need to hit this target is very much a media control narrative. It's about, okay, if we can hit this target and once it's done, we don't need to worry about hitting that target again because nobody's going to care. Unfortunately for them, Keir Starmer cares.
He cares about all of us, Steve.
Truly, he does.
But especially you, listener.
But yeah, so the government, as part of their core strategy for dealing with the coronavirus, has been one, the 100,000 figure was just pulled out of thin air by Matt Hancock in a daily briefing anyway. There's no logic behind it. And even then, their focus on that figure is solely to avoid bad headlines, which they sort of did for a day or two, and then they just let everything slip back because they don't know how to improve things better because they're so far behind on the thing that's actually going to help, which is a strategy for test and trace, where even pretty much every element of the strategy that we need to have in place for that isn't actually functioning because we don't have the testing levels we need. And the trace element, we're trying to use an app which doesn't really work or function properly as well, which is a separate thing to ruminate on at a later point, I suspect. And it's all because I feel they're focused so much on just trying to win the political argument, which is that because there's no political argument for them to win. Like, Keir Starmer isn't actually, for the most part, making a lot of political hay out of this. He's asking some poignant questions at PMQs, but that's it. He's not yelling about it. He's not going on about how the government is, committing an act of class warfare like certain former party leaders of the Labour Party have started doing.
Thinly veiled class warfare.
Yeah, thinly veiled class warfare. There's no drastic opposition. Like, the Labour Party has basically said, we support your efforts on this. Now just tell us how we're gonna fix this.
But again, just as if you have a SAGE committee which has no infectious disease specialists or any nursing specialists or a lack of female and BAME representation, it's going to steer you down a certain path. Mm-hmm. If you bring in Dominic Cummings into number 10 as your Svengali, you're going to go around a different path. And there's a very specific path, and that is a path in which you are essentially behave more like a campaigning organisation rather than a party of government. And, I mean, let's face it, again, to come back to the original sin of this government, for want of a better way of calling it, a lot of Tory MPs voted for Boris Johnson knowing he wasn't a suitable prime minister because they thought he could beat Jeremy Corbyn in an election. Yeah. And Boris Johnson brought Dominic Cummings into number 10 because he had a strategy to get a Brexit bill passed and win a general election. And those things happened. But now he's kept Cummings on. And there's an interesting Alva Ray article in the New Statesman website, which goes into this a little bit. It interviews a lot of former party leader comms and number 10 comms people about this stay alert slogan. And they think, well, actually, Cummings would have focus grouped the slogan, would have tested this slogan. I mean, personally, I think it comes from the sort of model compromise that we've talked about before in the Tory cabinet, but I might have to wait for the memoirs to bear that out. But what it what these comms people definitely say is that there's a definite obsession with winning that news cycle, and it's the government's behaving more like a campaigning organisation. So if number 10 was going to do this properly, if you were going to have, I mean, for a start, if you do it properly, you'd be doing the House of Commons. But if you're going to do it properly, you would have, OK, Johnson does his speech at 7. You publish the guidance at 7:30. Mm-hmm. You have a minister who comes on the, does the morning rounds and clears up any misunderstandings. And that what, I mean, as you already walked through us earlier, that didn't happen. That guidance wasn't there. People like Dominic Raab, Andrew Bridgen were going on saying things that, quite frankly, weren't accurate on the Monday morning shows. The guidance wasn't published, which just has more and more confusion. And again, those kind of anonymous briefings to the tabloid press, which then the press over-egged, a lot of that is almost like you're building up to this big moment, which then doesn't come. It makes sense if you're campaigning, but they're not campaigning, they're governing. The problem is they're not very good at governing.
Yeah, pretty much. That's exactly it. So much of everything they are getting wrong is because they're focused on this daily media narrative rather than the actual kind of strategy of dealing with the situation, which I think, as you say, a lot of that is coming from the people that are in the government and advising the government, who are campaigners, not governors. And they've not actually, for the most part, got that much interest in governing. Boris Johnson, he wants the trappings of being prime minister. He doesn't necessarily want the responsibility of being prime minister. This is quite, like, given he went away on in the early parts of the preparations for the pandemic and didn't attend key meetings and things like that. Like, that's the sign of somebody who doesn't want to be involved in the finer details. But really, what you need at the moment is somebody that is able to do that, because that's what's going to make the difference, and quite literally a life and death difference for an awful lot of people.
Are you saying, as Prime Minister, we need someone who is, dare I say it, forensic?
I was going to use the word strategic.
Also a good word.
And likely to be overused within the next month or so.
Certainly on this podcast, and in fact, we might talk about that with our Patreon subscribers. Potentially, we've got a podcast that's being planned again on Keir Starmer's leadership. There, yes, listeners, there was definitely a subtext in that last exchange. Now, we had some nice Zoom calls with our patrons over the last couple of weeks. Patrick Cook, our man in New York, was very kind. Hello, Patrick, if you're listening. He gave us an hour or two of his time and answered lots of questions on American politics. We're hoping to do another one with a special guest in a few weeks. So if you are a Patreon, keep your eye out for that on the Patreon page. What is our Patreon page, Steve?
Our Patreon page is patreon.com/notenoughchampagne. If you do sign up, you will get access to a number of unique pieces of content, which are only accessible to our backers on Patreon. Everything goes towards helping us run the podcast.
Do you have the last two people who subscribe so we can thank them?
Peter Lloyd and Neil Hazelhurst.
Thank you to you. I'll have to send you another bottle of whiskey. We'll have a podcast coming out on food chains. In the meantime, our website is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. James Crown designed the logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCrown. Dave Depper composed our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm on Twitter at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Acoustic Radical.
Happy plucking.